Welcome to Citizens Climate University, a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that provides CCL supporters with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host tonight, Morgan McHugh, and tonight's topic is Columbia University's assessment for a prestigious institution of the Energy Innovations Act's impacts on emissions, air pollution, and Americans' finances. It confirms that the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act is effective at reducing emissions and is good for people. And joining us tonight is Dr. Noah Kaufman, research scholar at Columbia University. So I'm going to go ahead and pass this on to Jerry to introduce our featured guest tonight.
Great. Thank you, Morgan. Hey, this is Jerry Hinkle, CCL's Economic Research Coordinator. We're really fortunate to have Noah with us tonight. I wanted to tell you a little bit about him. So he has a PhD in economics from the University of Texas, and he's really devoted his career to the evaluation of climate policy generally and carbon tax policy in particular. He is now the director of the Carbon Tax Research Initiative at Columbia University. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about the work that he's done that's particularly relevant for us. Noah helped put together a consortium that included Rhodium and the Baker Institute to model revenue neutral carbon tax policies. And they came out with a paper July 2018, evaluating a variety of revenue neutral carbon taxes. They then produced an analysis of the Market Choice Act introduced by Representative Carlos Curbelo. Later in 2018, a version of our bill came out, and they and Noah's group produced an analysis of sorts of our bill, sort of from a high level, but compared it to other carbon pricing bills that had come out. And now, so this is sort of the, for our purposes, the most recent product is a much deeper evaluation of HR 763. So we are so fortunate to have him be someone that is generous with his knowledge and his time. And he really is a partner to us. So please welcome Dr. Noah Kaufman.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Jerry and Morgan. I am always thrilled to help you guys out. I think, from afar, I've been a fan of your organization for many years and everything you guys do. I think Jerry mentioned, so I work for Columbia University, and at Columbia, I work for the Center on Global Energy Policy. We see our role as essentially we work for an academic institution, but what we're trying to do is not publish peer-reviewed journal articles. We're trying to answer questions that are relevant to both policymakers and business leaders and just influencers more broadly, and that certainly includes your group. So it's not really being a matter of being generous with my time. I see this as sort of a core part of our mission. The purpose of this presentation was to go over the results of our study, which was finalized maybe about a week ago now. I'm a little bit afraid that there might be some overlap here if some of you were at the annual meeting. Jerry and team were nice enough to invite me to the annual conference in DC, and I gave a very similar presentation on, at the time, our preliminary results, which, as preliminary results do, changed a little bit, but really you're going to hear a lot of the same themes and many of the same numbers if you heard that presentation. So, maybe there are some new people in the audience, but if you heard that one, hopefully this won't be too boring, and I will definitely try to leave a lot of time for questions. So I already sort of gave you the overview of the mission of our center as a whole. Jerry mentioned we have a specific carbon tax research initiative, which essentially has the same mission. We're trying to help policymakers design and consider carbon tax policies. We are not advocates for any policy or any different approach, but we're also not afraid of saying climate policy generally and a carbon price is a good idea in particular. You know, I think economists have widely recognized that for many decades. So this particular study, I should recognize the Rhodium Group, who is our sort of joint partner on this. They, led by a team, John Larson is the head of their team, and they run a version of what's called the NEMS model. So this is the National Energy Modeling System that is developed out of the Energy Information Administration of the Department of Energy. This is sort of the most well-known and widely used energy models in the country, or models of the U.S. energy system. It is not without its flaws, like every model, and I'll get into that a little bit. But I think Rhodium's own version of this model has been specifically developed to sort of better enable it to look at policies like this one, you know, that sort of take into account the potential future energy transition in a way that EIA's version is not necessarily designed to do. So essentially what we did was pretty straightforward. We tried to take the version of the bill that came out in early 2019, essentially, you know, model as many of the provisions of it as we could. You know, we used the tax rate trajectory that's in the bill, although I think we assume it starts in 2021. You know, we assume the full dividend. We put a proxy in our model for the border carbon adjustment that essentially assumes imports and exports remain relatively static. Other than that, I'm not going to go into too much detail about the policy itself on the theory that you all are the experts on that anyway. And I'll just sort of dive into what we found. So first I'll talk a little bit about emissions, impacts on energy markets, what we found on the dividends in terms of, you know, the size of the checks that folks get. And then at the end, I'll spend a little bit of time comparing the Energy Innovation Act to other carbon tax proposals in Congress. And actually, the caution on this slide says, this is a holdover from my presentation saying that they were subject to change based on expert review. Well, we did that expert review and made some very minor changes, but these are the final results that you're seeing. So first, let's start with emissions. And if you look at the results for, so these are economy-wide net greenhouse gas emissions. So that is everything, all of the big greenhouse gases in the energy sector, in the land sector. Net means that we're accounting for the land sector carbon sinks here too. So this is, you know, everything the bill covers and everything it doesn't. It's what drives climate change, you know, at least from a U.S. perspective. And what we find is that over the first 10 years, first of all, I think it's sort of important to see the blue line on top, which is that, you know, despite a lot of progress in specific sectors, our emissions trajectory under current policies is relatively flat over the 2020s. That's the bad news. The good news is that you put a policy like EICDA on top of it, and you get a big, big impact on emissions. So what we find is that emissions fall almost 40% below 2005 levels by 2030. And the reason we use that 2005 metric is that that's sort of the common benchmark that's used in the U.S. and also commonly internationally too, when you look at these international pledges. So the U.S. pledge to the Paris Agreement was 26% to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. This bill would bring the country well beyond that marker by 2025 and even further by 2030. It's important to see that if you break that out by sector, what you see is that most of those emissions reductions, at least in the early years, are coming from the power sector. And this figure hopefully drives that point home. You can see on the bottom, the lines on the bottom are just the power sector emissions, which are big. You know, they're right now about a third of total energy sector emissions. And this bill essentially takes care of them or most of them by 2030. But the progress in other sectors is much slower. So that is, first of all, in sectors like transportation, where you're certainly raising the price of gasoline, but you know, because consumers don't have the easiest ways to switch away from their vehicles, because stock turnover of the vehicle fleet takes time, that's a lot slower. And it also includes emissions, you know, from, for example, agriculture that aren't even covered by a policy like this. But that's why you see, you take sort of the big picture and you're sort of on a path to net zero by mid-century. In that first slide, you add this nuance to it and you realize there's still a whole lot of work to do in sectors outside of the electricity sector. This slide here sort of goes through all the reasons to be skeptical about the emissions results that I just showed you. You know, I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that this is one model of the U.S. energy system. And, you know, I think we should always take forecasts of energy systems with a grain of salt, especially when you see results from a single model. But even more specifically, it's worth noting that energy technologies are likely to change in ways that are hard to predict going forward. In particular, if we put a policy like this in place, we would expect the price itself to accelerate innovation in low carbon technologies, which would actually, we'd expect, make emissions fall even faster than we would predict in a model that doesn't take into account those dynamics, and ours and really no model does. Another fairly robust finding from the literature at this point is that when consumers see a carbon tax, they may respond in a way that's fairly different than if they just see a typical price change. So, you know, the prices of gasoline rise at the pump. Consumers may not notice. They may notice, but think, oh, that's just a temporary fluctuation. On the other hand, if they see a carbon tax, they see some permanence, and maybe they see it because they notice the policy change. So for that reason, we might expect the consumer reactions to be stronger than we find in a model like this. And then the other thing is that the last bullet point here, I think it's important to remember that what we're doing here is looking at just the carbon tax on top of the current policy scenario. In reality, I was going to get to this a little later, but you might think we need a whole series of policies to address greenhouse gas emissions. And to the extent we have complementary policies alongside of a carbon price, you could see emissions reductions that are quite a bit larger. So last thing on the emissions front, you probably know there's a mechanism in the bill that says if taxed emissions don't fall fast enough, the tax rate will increase more rapidly. And what we found was, at least through the 2020s, emissions are very likely to fall fast enough not to trigger that faster or acceleration in the tax rate. But once we get out to the 2030s, our model becomes, the results flip. And what we see is the reduction target emissions falls below the taxed emissions in the model. So that might mean, it's always possible our model is underestimating emissions reductions. We could put other policies in place to push down emissions further, or this is telling us if we do not, you might see that extra $10 a ton tax rate acceleration kick in at some point in the 2030s. Wanted to talk a little bit about energy market impacts And what you see is, number one, the impact on the left here to the coal markets. Coal production falls very dramatically by 2030. So this shows sort of the dark blue is coal production under current policies, which is below current levels, but you know, sort of a gradual decline from current levels. Whereas under this carbon tax, I'll show you the electricity sector results in a bit, but basically coal is driven out of the electricity system. So that is very good from an emission standpoint. It's very good from a public health and greenhouse gas emission standpoint, but it's also concerning in terms of the regions of the country that produce coal and you know, the sort of surrounding not just workers but communities and local governments. So that's something that policymakers need to be cognizant of. It really is a coal story. I mean, if you look at our results for natural gas, which we show here on the right, and even more so for oil, which we don't even show here, the impacts are quite a bit smaller. So I referenced the electricity generation. That's where a lot of the action is in the 2020s. What we find is that the carbon tax is a huge boost for renewables. If you look at the bar on the far right, renewables are almost half of electricity generation by 2030. We actually see a lot of natural gas with carbon capture and storage starting to come in by the late 2020s. There's really only one plant online right now, but at least according to sort of the supply curves in our model, that you know, a price signal that's as high as the one that the carbon tax puts in place by the 2030s is enough to get a lot of carbon capture and storage online. If that doesn't materialize, you'd probably see quite a bit more renewables than even we show here. And I think it's worth noting the nuclear bar on the top, or I guess the second to top also. This bill isn't going to put a lot of new nuclear online in the 2020s. There just isn't a lot of time for that. But what it will do is save quite a few nuclear plants that would have gone offline without it. A couple slides here just on prices. Of course, you hear a lot of people talk about the price impacts of carbon prices, and they are very real. You know, sometimes I hear carbon pricing advocates pushing back saying, well, we are taxing polluters and they won't necessarily be able to, you know, pass that price along to consumers. You know, I think they will find ways to do that, and our model suggests that they will also, at least in most cases. And for the gasoline prices, a rough rule of thumb is that for any every dollar per ton of carbon tax, you'll see maybe 70-80% of that in terms of dollars per gallon of, or I should say, I guess, cents per gallon of gasoline. So when you have in 2020 a $15 a ton carbon tax, you see the price of gasoline rise about 15 cents per gallon at the pump. And by 2030, that's up to almost a dollar per gallon at the pump. Electricity prices, sort of same story. I think people, you know, probably have less of a good idea of what their electricity prices are now, but you know, they will rise because you know, natural gas especially is setting electricity prices over lots of the country. So you see a rise in prices there too. And then if you look sort of from a broader standpoint, this is sort of energy expenditures per capita. So essentially what that means is we take total energy expenditures from the whole population, we divide it by the population. What we find is that the carbon tax raises energy expenditures over a current policy scenario by 20 to 25%. Although even in 2030, it's not quite at the peak it was at back in 2008. Important to remember, of course, that money that is spent in greater energy expenditures doesn't disappear. It becomes government revenue. And in this bill, it's just given back to the people. So they may be spending more in energy expenditures, but they get checks in the mail to compensate. So first of all, the sort of the gross carbon tax revenues rise to about $400 billion by 2030. So this is a lot of money. What we find is that when you sort of divvy that up the way the bill calls for and send checks to adults and children, by 2030, those checks are over $1,200 a year for an adult and about half that for children. The obvious question that comes next that people ask is, all right, so how do the checks that you get in the mail compare to the changes in energy expenditures? And it turns out that's a really hard question to answer because it depends on so many different things. But we tried to do it anyway. And you know, there's a lot of fine print in the paper giving caveats on why that, maybe don't take these results to the dollar. But in general, what we tried to do is say, what's an average household, including, typical adults and children in the household, going to get dividend payments, and how does that compare to the change in energy expenditures for your average household? And the results we thought were kind of neat. We didn't actually know that it was going to come out to be as sort of even as we found here. Where the dividend payments on average are really right about the same as the change in expenditures, which is a nice way of driving home the point that for your average consumer, this is kind of a wash. So one thing to keep in mind, and I could spend a whole hour on this alone, but when you think about how it's going to affect federal government revenues, there's a lot going on here. So a lot of times you hear these bills referred to as revenue neutral. It's not actually quite that simple. If you just look at the first order effects on government revenue, that's basically true, right? There's carbon tax revenue and it's being paid out in dividends. That roughly matches each other. But then you have these second order effects. First of all, there's something called the income and payroll tax offset, which I won't get into the details of, but the way to think about that is that businesses especially pay the carbon tax, and when they pay the carbon tax, that means they have less income to pay income taxes and payroll taxes. So turns out once you take account for that in an economic model, it ends up being a fairly sizable offset on the total revenues that the government brings in from the tax, something in the order of 20 to 25%. The bill, on the other hand, stipulates that the dividends themselves are taxed. And what we found is that that will increase revenue by about 10 or 12% of the total gross carbon tax revenues. And then you also have these third order effects that we don't even try to calculate, but think of like the multiplier effects. You send people checks in the mail every month. They're going to spend that money, right? And they're going to spend it in on consumer goods, and there'll be sales taxes, and it'll turn into someone's income, and there'll be income taxes. So you have all these third order effects that will influence government revenue also. So what we say in the paper is that it's really hard to know what the effects on government revenue are. If you take these first and second order effects into account, you probably have a slightly revenue negative policy in the near term. So just a few things I'll mention. This analysis was very focused on emissions and energy markets. Of course, there are other results that are important. You think about distributional impacts or impacts across the income distribution. You all probably know this, but a policy like this one is highly progressive. And what that means is that your average low-income household is going to get far more in dividend checks than they pay in essentially what they pay in the carbon tax in terms of energy expenditures. And the reason for that is that rich people just buy more of everything, including energy. So richer households are going to get a lot less in carbon dividends than they get in checks in the mail. So overall, you are seeing poorer households come out fairly comfortably ahead with a policy like this. In terms of macroeconomic impacts, hugely hard to say much about, both because our models aren't great, and it depends on the assumptions that you use. I think the important thing to know is that virtually all economists support carbon prices because it's sort of a necessary part of a strategy to reduce emissions cost effectively. So when you see results that show sort of negative economic impacts of a carbon tax or a negative effect on GDP, essentially what they're showing is that, you're putting a constraint on the economy. And anytime you put a constraint on the economy, that's going to sort of reduce economic growth compared to sort of a perfect world that frankly we don't live in, where all capital is allocated optimally. It's important to note that those studies don't account for things like, what we might do in the absence of a carbon tax, for example, putting in place a whole bunch of regulations that wouldn't be as friendly to the economy as a market mechanism. And of course, they don't account for any of the benefits of emissions reductions and how those might translate into economic impacts. And then finally, I sort of referenced this earlier, regional impacts, I think, are important to keep in mind, both from a political perspective and also in terms of equity, in particular for coal-dependent regions that are getting hit hard by a policy like this. Fortunately, the coal industry is relatively small. There aren't too many counties in the country that are dependent on coal. But the ones that are very dependent on coal. So again, it's something that policymakers need to be cognizant of. A few more minutes. What I'll do is talk a little bit about how this bill, EICDA, compares to, now there's quite a few different carbon tax proposals in Congress. I wonder if this is even fully up to date. We have 7 bills on here. I think this might be all of them. At least the ones that have been introduced this year. And what this slide does is compare tax rate trajectories. And you can see second to the top on the right is the EICDA bill. It was only eclipsed in terms of stringency by Senator Coons and Feinstein, the bill they put out earlier this summer. All else equal, the higher tax rate is going to lead to more emissions reductions. It might be worth noting that what we find in our model is there's quite a bit of diminishing returns. So, for example, any one of these tax rate trajectories is going to take the U.S. beyond the Paris Agreement targets by 2025. After that, you see more emissions reductions from higher tax rates, but really sort of taking coal out of the system in the 2020s gets you the biggest bang for your buck. And then revenue is the place where these policies differ otherwise. And here you see EICDA on the left with virtually all revenues being used for carbon dividends. Other policies take a lot of money and use them for things like infrastructure packages, or in a couple cases, reductions in the payroll tax. The idea there is you hear that called a tax swap, right? The idea is, the government needs to raise money. Why would we do it by taxing something we want more of, like income or hiring, when we could do it by taxing something we want less of, like carbon pollution? And I also think it's worth noting that the one thing that all of these policies share in terms of their revenue use is that they're all using at least a portion of the money to give money back to low, or in some cases low and middle income households. So there really is sort of a consensus out there at this point that a carbon tax policy has to have some progressivity to it, at least at the bottom end of the spectrum. And then one last thing is to think about what policies do to other existing policies and regulations, or sort of related regulations, because this is a big issue. You may have heard of the Climate Leadership Council proposal. This is the Republican put forward Baker Schultz proposal that has one of its pillars is preemption of existing federal regulations, and that's gotten a lot of pushback in sources. So you hear a lot of talk about what carbon taxes are going to do to existing policies, and you see differences among the proposals. You probably know that EICDA just sort of suspends EPA regulations of stationary source CO2 emissions that are covered by the tax, leaves everything else in place. The Market Choice Act, which was reintroduced by Congressman Fitzpatrick, goes a little bit farther than that, repealing the federal excise tax as well. Some of the other bills don't do anything to existing EPA regulations. I did want to show you a sort of bottom line chart from a different study we did that tried to get at this question by looking at how compatible other policies are with a carbon tax, sort of ranging from, on the left here, policies that are very complementary, go very well with a carbon tax, to all the way on the right, the policies that are most redundant with the carbon tax. And if you look on the right here, the most redundant policy are regulations of GHG emissions that are also covered by the carbon tax. So that very much are the stationary source EPA regulations that are being suspended by the EICDA proposal. So I think this is sort of points to the reason for that stipulation in this bill. And that's all I have.
Well, I want to say thank you to Noah. I thought that was a fabulous report. I mean, the truth is something like this, a revenue neutral carbon tax, a price on carbon generally, is so the right thing to do. And we know that. And the loss here is that we've been so slow to take action. I think your report, represents that, represents the important truth on the matter. And so, all of us at CCL genuinely thank you for your hard work, and we feel like partners in trying to get the right thing done.
Absolutely. Well, right back at you. Thanks again for inviting me to do this, and looking forward to working with you guys going forward.
Very good. You're welcome. Anything you need. So further questions on this front, go ahead and write to me. It's just Jerry, J-E-R-R-Y, @ citizensclimatelobby.org. And if I need to pass anything on to Noah, I will do so. Until then, Noah, we wish you the very best in future carbon tax research and other work that you're involved in there at the Center for Global Energy Policy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram @ Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.